Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
As to the fifth count of the information, Gage Grosskreutz, we the jury find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
Not guilty. Five times over. Kyle Rittenhouse, a Wisconsin jury, finding him not guilty of all charges in his double homicide trial. The 18-year-old always maintained he killed two men and injured a third in self-defense last year during social justice protests in Kenosha. Tonight, we discuss the law and the politics of the trial and the verdict. My guest is Glenn Ivey, former prosecutor and partner with Ivey and Levittown Law Firm. Lines are open. We want to hear from you tonight. What do you think about today's verdict and the trial? Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I invite you to tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Glenn, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So your reaction today, were you surprised? You for our former prosecutor, what do you think?
I can't say I was completely surprised. I was surprised that it was an acquittal across the board. I thought the jury might compromise and come back with a verdict of guilty on the reckless endangerment counts. But yeah, it's a tough one to swallow nonetheless, because of so many circumstances that I think would lead many of us to feel that he should have been held accountable for what he did that night, at least at some level.
One of the things that we saw last week before the jury went into deliberation was the dropping of the gun charge. He was 17 when this happened, and he was not legally of age to possess this firearm. Can you talk a little bit even about that before we get into the meat and potatoes of what happened today?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that I think the judge did that probably caught the prosecutors off guard and definitely hurt their case. The dropping of the illegal gun possession charge was certainly one of those, because that's another one of those where even if there's an acquittal on the other charges, from a prosecutor's standpoint, you're hoping to at least get a conviction there. The other ones I thought that really hurt was the judge's denial of their request to show a Rittenhouse video where he said he wished he'd had his rifle so he could have shot these guys. He was watching a video of people leaving a CVS. He presumed they were shoplifters, and that was the reaction he stated in a video. The judge excluded that from the jury's review. And then the other one that he excluded, too, was a photo of Rittenhouse with Proud Boys members. His defense attorneys argued that he wasn't a member of the Proud Boys, but I think all three of those pieces would have helped the prosecution put a case before the jury that showed this wasn't a guy who drove out of state to get to Kenosha, Wisconsin, just to be there and, you know, be helpful. He had something on his mind when he was driving there, and it was similar to what he said he was going to do in the CVS video.
But even without the Proud Boys evidence, let's talk about that piece about driving, because that is driving to Kenosha, Wisconsin. Because he left his state and drove to another state and armed, underage or not. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people find troubling. I find this troubling. Who asked you?
Right.
Yeah. And you went armed to another state and to protect property that wasn't yours, and ended up killing two people and shooting another person. That is the thing that I find most troubling, because one would believe that if you just stayed home and minded your business, that none of this would have happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, as you noted, you know, he took a loaded assault weapon, drove from another state to an area where there's an active protest and unrest going on, waves the weapon around openly. It's not like he was, carrying it in a concealed manner. The property owners hadn't asked him for his protection, so he went there without their request. Police officers were actually already there, and he violated a curfew order. I mean, when you add all of that up, it looks like a guy who, you know, brought a weapon to this event because he planned on using it when he got there. So I think there's a lot of evidence that was on that other side. You know, I'm sure, you know, legal commentators have been, especially those in Wisconsin, have been talking about the self-defense laws in that state and, you know, those being a major factor. But I think for many of us around the country, it's really surprising to see an acquittal on these facts.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and verdict today. He was acquitted on all five counts. He immediately left the state, and he is a free man. What do you think? Give us a call, 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Joe, calling from Upper Marlboro. Joe, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes. I'm going to tell you straight up, this is all set up to me.
Tell me straight up.
I don't believe that, I mean, the Republican Party is a strong party, and this guy says that he wants to make Carl Rittenhouse a person that works inside the White House because of what he did. I mean, come on now. If that was a young black male that did what he did, he would be charged. He would be thrown under the jail. That is incredible. I have never seen anything like this in the world. And our country has gone to crap because of this.
So let's make sure we get the information straight. First of all, you're talking about Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, and he was saying that he would make a good congressional intern, not a White House intern. So let's make sure that we have that information straight. That said, Matt Gaetz is a Republican congressman. You are right about that. And certainly the politics of this are very, very loud and clear, because you have people who are on the left who found this verdict to be very, very disturbing. You found people on, you know, on the right. And then there are, of course, Second Amendment advocates who were very, very supportive of Kyle Rittenhouse. And to that point, Glenn, talk to me about the Second Amendment aspect of this, because I think that raises a great deal of questions about how someone, let's throw out the fact that he was 17, but how someone could have just walked down the street with an assault rifle in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and not be shot.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key points is, you know, when people raise the issue, would, if this had been a black male, would the police have reacted the same way, is really on point. I mean, he shows up, he's carrying an AR-15, which is one of the deadliest assault weapons out there. And apparently police were, you know, saying things like, we appreciate you guys being here. And they were telling them, we're going to channel some of these guys towards you, speaking about Rittenhouse and some of these other militia vigilante types that had showed up. And more importantly, in some ways, that's what brought people like Rittenhouse to this place. And this happens at other protests, too. You know, the people on the right, Proud Boys and those guys, say, hey, come to this protest. Where, you know, there's There's a protest going on. These leftists are doing this, you know, activities in the streets. We need to come up there and bring our firearms and, you know, stand, you know, for whatever they're saying they stand for. And so you have usually white males showing up with heavily armed assault weapons to these kinds of places where frequently nobody else is shooting any weapons. No violence is taking place until they get there. And that's kind of what happened with Rittenhouse here. So I think it's, you know, it's a clarion call for, you know, vigilantes to start showing up at these events in greater force. And for people on the right, they think this is a vindication of their approach to dealing with protests. In this instance, this was a black male who had been killed, and that created the protests in Wisconsin. They think the approach is to, you know, show up with assault weapons on the other side.
And let's be clear, if you had watched any part of the testimony of Gage Grosskreutz, who was wounded but survived, he is a Second Amendment advocate. He said so on the stand. He did have a weapon. Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum did not have weapons, although that could be debated, because I believe that I think it was Huber, and forgive me, I don't remember. I think it was Huber who had a skateboard.
Huber hit him with the skateboard. But here's the question in the wake of this verdict. Because if there's an active shooter, if you're in a place where there's an active shooter, what are you supposed to do now? And, you know, Grosskreutz and I think Huber apparently rightly thought that Rittenhouse looked and walked like an active shooter, so they responded accordingly, which is to try and disarm him. You know, one of them was killed, another one was seriously injured, and a jury acquitted Rittenhouse for doing that. How are you supposed to respond in these situations now in the wake of this verdict?
Indeed. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and today's verdict. He was acquitted on all counts. Specifically, he killed two people, wounded a third. Let's talk to Clinton, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, Clinton. What's on your mind?
Well, the previous caller before me said he wanted to keep it real. I just want to keep it as real as it can. This is a lynching. This is Emmett Till all over again. This is a lynching. And this is a stark reminder to everyone that we're still living in highly volatile, racist times.
Now, how would you say that the Kyle Rittenhouse case is a lynching?
Because it is very, it's like driving while black.
Let me stop you there, because I don't want to get this confused, because none of the people who were shot and the person who was on trial was, none of these people were black. You may be getting this confused with the Ahmaud Arbery case, which is still going on. As a matter of fact, closing arguments are scheduled for Monday in Georgia. And I can understand how you might get these things confused, because these two high-profile trials are going on at the same time. But there were no black people involved in this particular case. Anthony Huber was white. Joseph Rosenbaum was white. Gage Grosskreutz was white. Is white, I should say. Kyle Rittenhouse is white. So let us make sure that we know specifically what we're talking about. And trust me, we will have plenty of time to talk about Ahmaud Arbery no matter what happens in that particular case. But I want to make sure we understand specifically who we are talking about. So let's make sure that we know. But thank you so much for your thoughts, getting ahead of a bit of the legal game here. So thank you so much about that. I do want to go to Kevin. Kevin calling from Virginia. Kevin, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Whoops, I think we lost Kevin. Let us go to Steve. Steve calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Steve. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I just wanted to address that the situation about Mr.
Kyle Rittenhouse.
Sure.
It just shows the continuous lack of respect for us as a people. It shows where we are at as a country. I know we've made a lot of progress over the years, but in a lot of different ways, we're still 400 years behind.
Why do you say that? Still,
because, I mean, you know, I know of a personal situation where a 17-year-old youth was actually convicted of a robbery with weapons that were involved. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Ivey was a state's attorney when that situation went into view. It was his first offense, never been in any trouble. 17 years old, he did 14 years, and no one got hurt. Now, can you explain to me how that can be, and then Mr. Rittenhouse can take two lives and devastate a third and walk free?
Okay.
It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling, but it just shows where we are at as a people, as a country, as a nation. And something has to be done. The disparity is unreal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly does require a lot of questions about our judicial system to be raised, as imperfect as it is, and it reminds us that it certainly is. I need to take a break, but when we come back, we have another guest who joins us and more conversation about the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict tonight. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, the app. Don't forget to download it on your smartphone, and you can hear the program live in its entirety. And don't forget, of course, it's on 98.3 FM as well. Stretches in for John Mons tonight with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. I'm Harold Fisher. This discussion continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are continuing our discussion of the law and the politics in the trial and verdict of Kyle Rittenhouse, a Wisconsin jury finding him not guilty of all charges in his double homicide trial. We continue tonight with Glenn Ivey, former prosecutor and partner with Ivey and Levittown law firm, and joining us now, Justin Hansford, executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Law Center at the Howard University School of Law. If you have comments or questions, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I invite you to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Justin, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Hey, Harold, thanks for having me.
I'm sure it's been a long and interesting, thoughtful day for you. Let me talk about some of the other aspects of this case today. And what is the thing that you found most mystifying or frustrating or concerning about this trial leading up to today's verdict?
Well, there's so many things to talk about, Harold.
Do we have enough time?
We have enough time, right? I mean, I would say that when you look at the confluence of open carry laws and standard ground laws, you know, it did remind me of the Trayvon Martin situation where these people are essentially going looking for a fight. And then by the time you get to trial, the somehow we are in a situation where there's a zooming in to just the moments of interaction. And in both cases, there is back and forth. There is a struggle where people are afraid for their lives because someone with a gun purporting to be an authority over them approaches them and you know, then someone loses their life. But to frame these stand your ground self-defense concepts in such a way that someone can travel from state, from different states even, or just going looking for a fight, and once they get to the fight and they find the fight that they're looking for, they're able to claim self-defense. It just doesn't make sense from just a basic justice standpoint. And then the only way to really understand it and make sense of it is to add the racial element, because it wouldn't even make, it wouldn't even be logical to think that if the shoe was on another foot, you know, some, you know, black kid goes to a march of, you know, the Proud Boys with an AR-15 or something, you know, that, and that's not even, it's not a good analogy, because Black Lives Matter protesters weren't out there looking to be provoking things. People, you know, he approached them. So it's just, it's just so many ways you can go with it. From the legal perspective, it's upsetting. From the political perspective, it's upsetting. I worry about Black Lives Matter protesters going forward. It was already a life and death situation just going to a protest in general. Now you've got to be afraid that there could be a vigilante who may feel emboldened when you go to a Black Lives Matter protest going forward. So there's so many reasons to be upset tonight. And I have to say this, with the Ahmaud Arbery trial coming to a close and that decision coming soon, I worry that we might see the same thing happen there. With if you zoom into the moments before Ahmaud Arbery was shot, he also, you know, he, I would have done the same thing. You have people approaching you with guns, and, you know, you're trying to defend yourself and save your life. And if you allow the justice system to zoom into that moment and say, well, that, you know, that person had a right to be scared because the person who's dead now was fighting back. I mean, that just makes the self-defense concept almost just logically nonsensical. I mean, people are in situations where folks approach them picking a fight, and if they dare to try to defend themselves or survive, then that person can, the aggressor, the initial aggressor, can argue self-defense. So, well, one of the things that I'm upset about is we're looking at the Ahmaud Arbery trial, and I think If this is how we're going to think about self-defense, I don't feel good about that outcome either.
Well, let's sidebar it just for a moment and talk about, and let's back it up even before the self-defense piece in the Ahmaud Arbery situation, because one of the things that I did see that really struck me in really watching that is that the McMichaels were talking about, and we're not going to dwell on this a whole lot, but, you know, since you did bring it up, that the McMichaels were talking about the fact that they did approach Ahmaud Arbery as he was jogging through their neighborhood and were questioning why he didn't stop when they said they wanted to talk to him, the audacity of white privilege in that case, where, mm-hmm. you know, why didn't you stop when I said I wanted to talk to you? You know, and my DMV attitude as a black man is, who are you?
Oh, yeah.
Excuse, you know, and let us say, you know, I am quite sure that in his 20, you know, 5-year-old Georgia attitude is, who are you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so I'm sure that. You know, I was really, really surprised at that. But we're going to save that for next week or the week after when that comes up. And I'm sure that we're going to call on you again to provide some input as it relates to that. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Kevin, calling from Virginia. I think we may have lost you earlier, Kevin, so thanks for calling me back. What's on your mind?
Yes, I had a question for Mr. Ivey. As it relates to this Rittenhouse trial, he transported a firearm across state lines. Now, is it possible that the federal government could decide to get into this? Because my understanding is something like that is actual a crime. You're not supposed to be able to transport a firearm across state lines.
Well, it's a great question. If you're carrying it illegally, then absolutely. And you know, sometimes people, especially in the DMV, because we've got so many lines around the district, Maryland and Virginia, sometimes you can legally carry a gun and say, I don't know, Virginia, you drive into D.C., and it's not legal for you to carry it there, and people have been prosecuted under those circumstances. So that's one that they should look at. Here's the challenge, though, you know, because a lot of people, I think, are going to say, can the Department of Justice take a look at this? And there's some limitations on that, because normally when we have this scenario, these are actually police officers who are, you know, officers of the state. And so most of the civil rights laws are aimed at prosecuting officers who abuse their authority under state color of law. Here you got a private citizen, so it makes it harder to do. But there may be some other angles for them to pursue. And then I think, you know, this is certainly a less satisfying option, but I do think there are going to be civil suits, maybe like the ones you're seeing in Charlottesville right now, where Rittenhouse gets sued, but also the police department, if they encourage these guys to, hey, we're glad you're here and that kind of stuff, and made it seem like they were happy they were there carrying their guns openly and you know, treating them like they should potentially use them, they might be liable. And you might also see these vigilantes who were calling people to come, like you are with the January 6th protests, where the FBI is sort of tracing back who generated this, who prompted people to come, and trying to figure out if they can prosecute or sue them as well.
Yeah. Kevin, thank you so much for that question. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Elliot, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, gentlemen. Good evening. My only question is what you guys think of the judge involved in the Rittenhouse case, maybe a previous history or his proceedings, that maybe some comments you might have had of how he conducted the trial, and also maybe the past history, maybe some potential bias, and just your general thoughts on the judge involved.
Justin, I'll let you start with that, and then Glenn, go right
ahead.
Yeah,
you know, I'm fascinated by that judge. This does speak to a bigger problem of judges who are elected. That's a judge who is in a part of the country where maybe it might look good to be supporting Rittenhouse. You know, Attorney Ivy might be able to provide insight on this. I was really shocked to see a judge receive a phone call in the courtroom and have the ringtone be some sort of song from a Trump rally. It's almost as if he could have, maybe he planned that or something. It just seemed like it was so, he was playing a character that was so out there. I almost wonder if it was on purpose to try to you know, encourage some of his conservative supporters. But that you would think, in terms of most of the commentators' views of his behavior, and I'll have to be honest, I have to look at the rulings. I didn't see specific rulings that I looked at and said that was clearly a biased ruling. It was more his antics that showed a lot of bias, and you know, I think that it was to the extent that I wonder if there was something I would look at. I would look at his election history. He's run unopposed, I believe, since the 1980s in that jurisdiction. He's run as a local judge in an election that was unopposed, and you would hope that going forward that there would be some focus on running a judge that could oppose him and provide another perspective on the bench. But that whenever you have judicial elections, I'm not big on judicial elections for this type of reason, because I think it does provide incentives for judges to make put on these types of political performances.
Glenn, your thoughts about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we mentioned some of the rulings that I thought were damaging to the prosecution, especially excluding the video with Rittenhouse saying he wished he'd been there with his rifle so he could have shot these guys leaving the CVS, and blocking the Proud Boys photo. Banning MSNBC from the courtroom I thought was a little strange. I don't know that that would have affected the jury's, you know, perspective, since it really didn't happen in front of them. There were some other things I thought he did where I thought the prosecution brought it on themselves, you know, trying to slip in the information that he had excluded. Whether I disagree with that or not, once the judge says it's excluded, you can't just try and pretend like it's okay for you to throw it out in front of the jury on cross-examination. I thought the judge chewed the prosecutor out appropriately for that. But, you know, I think on the whole, the challenge with judges, elected and appointed, you know, because we run into some of these issues with appointed judges at the state and federal level, is really what perspective do they bring to the courtroom? And, you know, sometimes even if you get a conviction, the perspective comes out at sentencing where, you know, convicted, say, police officer gets the kind of sentence that you wouldn't expect a regular person, so to speak, to get under those circumstances. So I do think it's important for us to, whatever the selection process is, we've got to raise the standards and make sure that one of the things we vet all of these judges for is how they view these kinds of cases, and to what extent they're aware of the impact on race in these kinds of situations. Mm.
Elliot, thank you so much for your question. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Pamela, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Pamela. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm in Maryland, but I'm from Mississippi. So I have a couple of thoughts. One, to that earlier caller, being from Mississippi, we are ultra, ultra sensitive about, we know what lynching is. We know what it means. We know what it looks like. People need to be, they need to do a lot more research. They need to know what lynching really is before they use that term. Secondly, we also know code. Everything about this hearing, we saw the code. I have friends, we've been talking about it. I couldn't even watch it after one day of watching this judge. There's so much code language going on. There's like a wink, wink in this country that, okay, you can stand your ground. Stand your ground now means you can protect yourself, or you can even go on the offensive, which this guy did. You can offensively kill people that you disagree with, wink, wink, if it's, you know, against that Black Lives Matter stuff. There's just a lot of code going on in this country right now, and I understand that none of these folks were African-American. The code message I feel that came out of this is don't even think about being an ally. Hmm. Don't be a Black Lives Matter protester. Don't think about being an ally, because this is what we're going to do to you. I don't know what to tell the young people in my life now. I have to fear every day that they go out that something will happen to them, and now we have to fear that we'll be shot down like dogs in a protest.
Interesting, interesting, thoughtful information that you're sharing with us, Pamela. Thank you so much. You were about to say something. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I thought the code point was right on the money. And yeah, one of the judge's rulings, for example, was you can't call these people victims.
Yeah,
but you can talk about looters and rioters. Now, that's the kind of message that's very problematic and really does send a message to the jury, potentially, that, you know, the judge already has a view on who these guys are, or at least he's allowing the defense to present a view that's contrary to what the prosecution had in mind and probably contrary to what the people who were there were actually doing.
Yeah, and there's no, and as far as I know, there's no evidence that suggested that any of the three people who were shot were looters or rioters.
Exactly.
And so I think that was problematic, which goes to the point that, you know, what Pamela was suggesting. So, Pamela, thank you so much for sharing with us. One of the things before I go back to the phone lines that I think is really important, I submit that this was a massive, massive public safety failure. Because, again, you have this teenager, and even if he was an adult, whether he was black, whether he was white, whether he was young, whether he was old, if he was not in a police uniform, if he was not in a National Guard uniform, which he was not, he's walking down the street with an assault rifle. And I'm still trying to come to grips with the fact that no one in a public safety capacity, sheriff, police, National Guard, who saw him, did not stop him and say, hey, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you here? And if he said, well, I'm here to protect, you know, the people, the area, or what have you, and someone in authority say, okay, young man, this is what I need you to do. See the way that you're facing now? I need you to do a 180-degree turn, and I need you to go back to where you came from. And I think that that is the public safety failure that happened in Kenosha. Because if he had done that and was respective of police, as the narrative was prior to going to trial was, then he would have, this wouldn't have happened. These men would have still been alive. This third man would not have been shot by Kyle Rittenhouse. But instead, the police, they allowed this to happen because they saw him and nobody stopped him. And this was a public safety failure.
I would just say I would agree with that, Harold, and that logic that you articulated was not the logic of the police department. They did interact with Kyle Rittenhouse and others who were coming from other places. And this is not just the Kenosha Police Department. You saw at Black Lives Matter protests around the country, the presence of different vigilante groups. One group was calling themselves the Boogaloo Boys.
Yes.
Yeah. All of these groups around the country were able to attend these protests with firearms. I mean, in some ways, it's a miracle we only had one or two or just a handful of these incidents. Where it could have been on a much larger scale, because almost universally across the country, we did see police departments take the position, whether it was from a Second Amendment perspective or whatever the case may be, that these people did not need to turn 180 degrees and go home, but they allowed them to have this presence on the grounds that they were somehow going to be, if not technically deputized, but at least in their imagination, deputized to play the role of citizens, patrolmen or something of that nature. So that's a conversation that I have not seen or heard today that is very valuable. Why is it that police departments around the country seem to allow these groups to happen? Even back in Ferguson, we had a group of folks who call themselves the Oath Keepers.
Yes.
Coming around to the protest. Later on, they would show up at the January 6th event, riot, which is what it was. These groups are, historically, we do know, and currently, we do know that there is infiltration between some of these militias and vigilante groups and personalities and police departments, which is something that the FBI released a report on about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, but we have not seen an explanation as to why that continues to happen. And we know that, and the thing that's unsaid is that we know that if you or I showed up at this protest with the AR-17 and said, I'm going to go patrol, that we probably would be treated a lot differently than Kyle Rittenhouse would be treated when he showed up. So that is something that is a really important conversation that we haven't been having that we should have going forward.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ricky calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Ricky. What's on your mind?
How you doing today? I would touch on what, you know, if you look at the laws of the land itself, I mean all over the United States, one law supposed to apply for everybody. The same law supposed to apply for everybody. But when they pick their juries, they got an all-white jury. When they pick our juries, they mix. They don't have all-black jury. But I'm not using the color. I don't want to use the color code for what's going on today. The old laws pre-exist because of the old people are still existing today in political places, political jobs, and everywhere. They're not changing the law. They're using the law to benefit them. And it works like the young man was killed in Florida, like the slaying was done in Washington, D.C., with a young lady who failed to stop for a barricade, and all these police shot at her car. She was carrying a baby in there. Look at these laws. Look at what's going on now. And look at what's happened to us now. They still, the more and more that we try to vote and get these people out of here, the more they're doing to change the law to better suit them so they can continue to keep fighting, enforce their rules and regulations, their policies, and their procedures. If you look at it, Trump didn't get convicted or nothing that happened down there, and you knew it. He got expelled from the Internet. He got expelled from this. He got expelled from that. But what laws were used against him? All he did was recreate the racial boundaries and open it up to where, though, hey, it's still alive. Well, people can speak out and say it now.
Well, I think you do make an interesting point, particularly as it relates to the former president, because, you know, we were supposed to be seeing some documents a week ago today that did not happen. And looks like the former president and his legal team are going to be trying to run out the clock. But I suspect that who knows what we may see before the end of the year. Who knows? There may be a Christmas surprise or something coming from.
Don't count on it.
I don't know.
Back so much money.
I don't know. Can I say that I have faith in the court system, or is that's blasphemy after today? I don't know. But Ricky, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I'll start with you, Justin. I think you kind of touched on this a little bit. Even though these are two totally different cases, what does today's verdict portend for the Ahmaud Arbery case moving forward?
Yeah, I do. You know, the history has grouped these cases together, you know, to happen side by side, these vigilante cases. And I'm very concerned that in these cases where vigilantes are claiming self-defense, just like the George Zimmerman trial, that there's this ability to zoom in on the moment of the gunshot. And if there's any sort of struggle or something of that nature at that moment, then these self-defense laws are being activated. And it's very curious to me that people are going looking for a fight, whether they're coming from across state lines or whether they are trapping people who are just out jogging, find the fight, and then at the moment of interaction, if the person who has been trapped lifts a finger, then you can say, I started the fight, but now I'm scared and I'm defending myself. And you know, I'm continuing to think about it, just in terms of what the juries and others are thinking as they conceptualize self-defense as something that is only going to be something you zoom in the moment, as opposed to looking at the overall context. And I feel like the Ahmaud Arbery trial could be a similar situation. We've got, I think there's one black juror in the Ahmaud Arbery trial. And I am very concerned about that happening back-to-back. And if it does result in an acquittal, these two acquittals back-to-back will be just a tragic, horrible message that will make us have to reevaluate a lot of the... You know, we were already skeptical of the justice system or the legal system, I should say, as opposed to the justice system. We were already skeptical, but, I mean, to have those two cases... turn out that way back to back would really be jarring.
Same question, Glenn. What does this portend heading into the this last round of the Ahmaud Arbery case trial, I should say?
Well, you know, hope springs eternal, I guess. I mean, you know, the case in Arbery is stronger, I think, from a prosecution standpoint. But, you know, it's as we've been discussing, I mean, this is Georgia. This is 11 white jurors. This is three white men saying they felt scared for their lives. You know, and all of those factors, you know, I'm not confident. Unfortunately, I remember that, you know, Harold, I think Scott Boland and I were on your show after the Derek Chauvin conviction and sentencing. And, you know, there was hope that came in that moment. But I don't know if we're going to have that same hope after this verdict coming up. And certainly it's a big blow to it today.
Let us hope that in that case that the jury instructions are not as confusing, convoluted, and as much of a circus as they were in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. My goodness. Everyone needed to be a law professor to understand that, including the judge. Because I must say, having been on a jury twice, and I'm a reasonably intelligent person, I was completely confused. So, something to think about moving forward. Glenn Ivey, thank you so much. Also, Justin Hansford, I really appreciate your time and your intellect, and we will be in touch.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Absolutely. Good night.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, November 19th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryan, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Good night, and have a wonderful weekend.